Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, my first guest this morning is a man whose life is stranger than fiction. He has gone from show business and opening Dublin's first gay nightclub to having to fight to be released from a South African prison. It's fair to say that Liam Ledwidge was a bit of a trailblazer, as well as an entrepreneur in Ireland in the 70s, 80s and 90s. But then he fell victim to an elaborate scam when he moved to South Africa. And he's with me now. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Miriam. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Listen, your life story should be a movie.
Oh, thank you very much.
There are people who will know you, Liam, from what you started in the mid-70s in terms of being an entrepreneur in Dublin entertainment and the gay scene in particular. Remind people, will you, of the nightclub you began running with your former partner, Tony Kyogan, and why it was so significant back then in Ireland?
Well, it happened on the 5th of December, 1975, when we opened Ireland's first gay commercial nightclub. And as you know, Miriam, the laws in those days were illegal. We went back to 1861 to a Victorian law. And so, you know, to open a gay commercial nightclub was kind of unheard of. So what we did was we had to, well, out of courtesy, we went to Fitzgibbon Street Garda Station and said, we had the proclamation in hand, you know, where to let them know that all the children of the nation should be treasured equally. But we didn't need to use that. So we went up into the Garda Station and there was a guard there. And I said, excuse me, or I said, oh, or something like that. He said, yes. I said, do you have any objections to us opening a gay commercial nightclub in North Great George Street? He said, oh, get on with it. And that was it. And we never had any complaints. No official complaints.
I love it that he just said, go for it.
Get on with it.
Yeah, which is great. Was it important, Liam, in terms of the scene in Ireland, and I suppose in Dublin in particular at the time, there were some pubs or bars seen as gay pubs, but no nightclub that was, not so much exclusively, but was able to open and trade and being a gay nightclub then. So it was a first, really.
No, we kind of mixed the two in order to gently ease the whole situation. We didn't want to come down like a ton of bricks on the nation because people were saying, oh my God, what the hell is this? You know, so we mixed show business with the gay element. Mm-hmm. And so it gradually developed from there. But we had a very good friend who helped us develop this. And you're too young, Miriam, to remember him.
Miles, too young.
He was a journalist called Terry O'Sullivan.
Okay.
And Terry O'Sullivan was a reporter, journalist with the Evening Press back
then. Nuala O'Fuilleann's dad.
That's Nuala O'Fuilleann's father. And Nuala O'Fuilleann was later to cover our horse and carriage nearly 20 years later. So it was a strange kind of thing to happen, like father and daughter.
Yeah.
So anyway, and to get back to the point in relation to Terry, he gave us publicity. And it's not, I'm not telling any tales out of school here, Miriam, but Terry loved his drink and he loved his mistress and all of that. That's been widely publicised. So every so often he would pop into the club, have a few drinks, report and take the odd photograph. And there we were in the press. So people were reading us every night of the week. Well, every other week, I should say.
But the pressures then were so different. We were talking about this before we went on air, Liam. I mean, the pressures on young gay people like you, they were horrendous, weren't they?
They were horrendous, but we were doing something different and we had to have fire in our bellies. You know, we had to be positive about it. We had to have courage to do something like that. And of course, when you delve into the deep, you'll always find someone who's going to help you. And that's what happened to us. And we got courage. And of course, especially from my family and, you know, from my mother and my grandmother, we were always encouraged. Now, unfortunately, as you and I know, not every person in Ireland today has that.
Tell me briefly about your own mom then. Like, I mean, she was obviously grand and supportive of you when you said you were gay and running this nightclub.
My mother was always very central to my life. And so too was my grandmother. And she took part in everything. She came everywhere with us, like Tony and I travelled the world and she came with us and that type of thing. And but she was a beautiful person. She even counselled young gay men and women in those days when she'd come into the nightclub. And I had a row with her one time because this guy asked her to go out to Cabra to see his meet his father. He said, who will certainly not accept him as being gay. Mm. So I had to drive her. Tony and I drove her out to Cabra and she went in and she was an hour in there talking to the parents. And then he came out and she said to me, by the way, I've invited them to the club on Saturday night. I said, oh, Mom, I said, that's the busiest night of the week. You know, but she says, that's the point. You see, they will see what other people are doing, you know, dancing and accepting each other. And she said, this is very important, she says, that they see this. I said, could you not have picked or chosen a quieter night?
She sounds great, your mom. Now, listen, in the early 80s, you had the idea to set up the Incognito Sauna Club for gay men. I think that was in Bow Lane East in Dublin too.
Yeah, that's right.
But of course, Liam, it came to national and international attention after the sudden death of a priest on the premises, Father Liam Cosgrave. Tell us a bit about that time and what happened.
Yes, well, that catapulted us into world news headlines. And it was very tragic for his family, of course. And Father Cosgrave, you see, so most people won't know this. Father Cosgrave, he lived out in Baldoyle, and his presbytery was broken into some months previous or prior to that. For some unknown reason, Miriam, he invited the Sunday World in and they took photographs. So when he died, this was like manna from heaven. Mm-hmm. They had the photographs of the dead priest. And of course, he was all over the newspapers. We were hounded by the press. And I remember asking the producers of, well, I was did regular spots on the Jerry Ryan show in those days. And I asked the producers if we could go on to try and put this to rest. And they kindly did. And journalist John Farrell, who also worked on the show, summed it up basically. I'll just read the last paragraph of that for you, Miriam.
Okay.
Where he says, although much remains to be done, it was in great measure Ledwidge's sympathetic reaching out to the bereaved that allowed his gay colleagues to mourn side by side with the members of his own congregation in an attitude of mutual acceptance and respect. And that, I think, covered everything. You know, it kind of gave some peace, if you like, to his family, that were his remaining family. And having said that too, Miriam, if you don't mind me saying this, the church is full of many, many good men and women today, and they rarely get recognised. And one of my closest friends is Father Joe MacDonald down in Selbridge. You know, and I'm always saying to him, you know what, Joe, I'm going to get you fitted out for a red hat one of these days. And he just say, don't you be saying things like that. And I can assure you now, he's probably rocking in his rocking chair in Selbridge this morning, listening to that.
Oh, that's a lovely tribute to him. Now, that club was destroyed, I think, by fire some months later.
Yeah.
But despite what some people thought and what conspiracy theories may have floated around, it was an accident, wasn't it? And you were able to reopen.
We did. Of course, the right winger said it was the hand of God that came down on top of us. But in actual fact, it was a genuine accident. Mm. And we opened within a year, so we were back in business. And then we opened the Horse and Carriage. And Danny LaRue opened that for us on the 23rd of September, 1993. And we were the first gay couple then to win that particular year, to win the Dublin Chamber of Commerce Award, Business Face Award, 1993. And then in 1996, Danny LaRue and I represented the Horse and Carriage in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And then afterwards, Jack Charlton threw a party for us in the Bagot Inn. So that was all very positive.
Oh, those were the days.
Yeah.
Now, listen, like happens with many couples, yourself and Tony split up.
Yes.
And I think that was initially, was that why you went to live in South Africa?
That is correct. Yeah. In 1999, we split up and it wasn't me who decided to go, but between the two of us, you know, we just felt that it was time to part and go on to greener pastures, if you like. And so I left for South Africa, but I was I was very vulnerable. I was in despair going there. But I was also very positive because I had to be. I was going to invest in a business in Cape Town, a guest house out there in a bar called Casablanca overlooking Robben Island, where Nelson Mandela spent 18 of his 27 years.
Now, you also, when you were there, I think your sister lived there, but you fell victim, Liam, to an elaborate scam involving some family friends and you ended up in prison. It's a bit of a complex story, but tell us briefly what happened.
Well, as you said, they were extremely influential people, Miriam, and they said, you know, we look after everything. We will get you organised here. We will get you a passport and so forth and so on, you know. So I trusted them because I had known them for several years. And one of them was a quadriplegic. And my brother-in-law, as a doctor, had saved his life. So they were kept saying, oh, this is for the doctor. This is for the doctor. But anyway, to cut the story short, I was scammed out of a million rands, which was £100,000 in those days. And so in order to cover their own tracks, I'm cutting the story short here, I'm just giving you the general idea because you can read it all in the book and we haven't got all day.
Yeah.
But they, in order for them to cover their tracks, they said that I had gone for a fake marriage to a black woman in a black township in Lamontville, which is a black township in South Africa. I had never met this woman. I had, why, like a famous gay person, why would I want to get married? You know, and this was the basis for the conviction with the police.
Because basically they were saying it was to get a citizenship, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. yes, yes.
Well, look, the thing is, on appeal, actually.
Yes.
That was overturned.
So it kicked out.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And she, three appeal judges who were white kicked it out and castigated the sentencing magistrate.
But not before, Liam, you had spent 77 days, I think,
That's
in one
correct.
Of the worst prisons on the planet, Westville
God.
Prison.
Yeah.
Tell me about that prison. Yeah, tell me about
Absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, the pits of hell it was, Westville Prison. I mean, the food was stale bread with pig's fat in the morning, and they would give you tea, well, an excuse for tea, which was like licorice. Oh, it was obnoxious. For the dinner, you would get a watery stew with some potato, some carrots, some celery, and that was it. 5 minutes to eat your breakfast and 10 minutes to eat your dinner. And you could see the rats running around the kitchen. The cells were lice-ridden, urine-infested mattresses. The blacks were beating each other. There was the gangs there. You know, the drugs were rampant. And, of course, if one didn't do what one wanted within these gangs, they would, you know, beat each other and do all kinds of things and rape each other.
And who were you incarcerated alongside?
Everyone. I at one stage, there was 100-odd prisoners and one toilet in the one room that everybody had to use the toilet in front of everybody else. And then it came down to I was in a cell with 85 people.
How did you, during that time, Liam?
Sorry?
How did you survive that? Like, what resources did you draw on to say, I'm going to try and get through
this
thing?
I was an altar boy for 10 years in my childhood, and my faith sustained me right through. And I don't know how I got through it, but I did. And it was because my belief in God that allowed me to, you know, to survive, so to speak. But my mental health was extremely challenged.
Because it was such a long, long way from the kind of lifestyle you'd be living in
Absolutely.
Dublin.
Oh, my God. Like, talk about the prince and the pauper. That's the way my life went.
Did you ever despair during that time?
There was one or two moments I did have despair, yes, yeah.
Like what?
Well, you just felt like, you know, ending it all. You'd see people committing suicide out there and you'd say, how did they do that? And then you'd have to snap out of it and just continue. But like I said, when I got home, my doctor, the family doctor, Fergus Purcell, said, oh, my goodness gracious, mate, we'll have to get you better again. And he did. And he wanted me to, well, he didn't want me. He asked me if I would like some antidepressants. And I said, hell will freeze over before I use them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I basically survived myself. And my best friend of nearly 50 years, Alex Carroll, is a clinical psychologist. So I used to bounce off of him, you know. But I wouldn't recommend that at home now to anybody who's suffering with depression or anything like that. Go and see a counsellor or speak to somebody. Or the best thing that you can do is when you're like that, you know, if you write it all down, it's very rehabilitating when you write it down. Go for a long walk, come back and read it again and then speak to somebody. But don't start anything stupid. Don't be trying to think of committing suicide. You know, you have to have courage. And was it Ernest Hemingway, I think, said, man can be destroyed but never defeated.
Interesting. And also, Liam, I think people find out who their true friends are when they're at their lowest moments. I mean, did your friends, your circle, did they always believe in your innocence?
They disappeared, apart from a few. Yeah, they disappeared. Mm. And it broke my mother's heart, really, you know.
That so few people stood by you.
Yeah.
Can you understand, maybe looking back now, Liam, that maybe they thought, at the time before the appeal overturned it, that maybe you had been guilty? I mean, in other words, is that the way they were thinking, which is why a lot of them abandoned
possibly,
you?
You know, that it's possible that they were thinking like that. Who am I to judge? I'm not being judgmental on anyone. But, like, how could you believe, Miriam, you know, that a gay man would look to a woman to get married. For what? For what purpose? What did it achieve? It achieved nothing. And why would I go down that route?
Sounds right. Now, you weren't allowed in court for the appeal, but when you got word of it,
yes.
How did it feel?
Oh, I was elated. My sister got on the phone, my sister Yvonne, and she got on the phone and she was absolute. She could hardly speak. And then my advocate, Jimmy House, who was a wonderful, wonderful barrister, he got on and he said to me, on behalf of the right-thinking people of South Africa, we want to apologise to you.
Yeah. Did you leave pretty immediately?
I got out on that Tuesday and I was on a flight on Friday.
Wow.
Arrived back into Dublin on the Saturday night, because I spent the day in London with my sister, my other sister.
And as well as obviously getting great help for your mental health, did your friends come back? I mean, and what happened? The circle you'd left and the world you'd left, was it very different when you came back?
Well, it was, because you see, Miriam, I had to start caring. My mother got very ill from it, you know, and she was absolutely wonderful, you know, to me. And so too was her friend and my friend, the late Maureen Beggs. They were absolutely wonderful. But when my mom became ill, I had to care for her. So that my life of yesteryear had to stop, you know, the gallivanting and going all around the world and this type of thing, and enjoying myself and working hard and working late and all of these. Because we did work very, very hard. But that had to stop. I had to work differently because I was looking after my mother. And when you're looking after a human being, and especially someone that you love, it takes, you know, that's why my heart goes out to carers today. They are given every single minute of their time to caring in the devotion for their loved ones.
Got a nice text here, Liam, for you. Hi, Miriam. I met my first boyfriend in Liam's basement nightclub in North Great Georgia Street in 1976. I'll always remember those social nights, thinking initially I would have always to live my life in the shadows. How times have changed in 44 years in Ireland. That's from Paul and Beaumont.
Oh, that's very nice.
I was actually talking to my producer, Tom, just before we came down to do the show. Like, people had to live, didn't they, in such secrecy back then?
Yes,
it must have been so terrifying.
It was terrifying. And one thing always sticks out in my mind, Miriam. I remember this guy, very, very good looking chap he was. And he came to me one Friday and he said, "You know what, Liam?" He said, "It's great." He said, "Thank God it's Friday." He said, "Because when I go into work on a Monday morning, I cannot tell my workmates or my family where I have been, you know, because I'm here Friday, Saturday and Sunday nights with the family that I enjoy being with." And so like that, it was kind of strange, Miriam, because I could go to my family, I could go to my gay friends, I could mingle, you know, I had no problems with that. And here was a guy, and he wasn't on his own, you know, that he had to live a sheltered life.
When you look back in your extraordinary story now, how do you feel about it all? I mean, it's such an extraordinary life, Liam.
Well, yes. My editor, the lovely Linda Harris from Cornwall, is listening in to us this morning, Miriam, along with many of her friends. So good morning to you all in Cornwall from Miriam and myself and
Absolutely.
Everyone here in Dublin. And she said to me there last week, she said, "You know, one thing that you did write in the book, and you should say it on Miriam's show," and I did say it was "Courage in the Darkness of Despair is the backbone of strength, and courage lies within all of us."
Absolutely. And your book, I loved it. It's called I Am Somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's your story. And you mentioned that parish priest earlier, Father Joe, and he's a lovely tribute in the back. He says, "Liam's story is one of injustice, brutality and torture, but it oozes real hope and ultimate joy. It stands as a very beautiful story. I defy anybody to read this book. Put it down and forget about it, even if you wanted to do this. It's not possible." Liam Leverage, thanks so much for being my
guest.
Just
before you let me go, very briefly, can I say that the profits of the book, Miriam, are going to Brian Merriman's Dublin Gay International Theatre Festival and the Simon Community.
That's lovely. Listen, Liam, thanks so much for being my guest.
It's been a real pleasure. You're a lovely lady. And Scott, I'm delighted to have met you.
Thanks a million.